Hi, I'm Konstantinos Komaitis.
And I'm Gillian York, and this is the Internet of Humans.
For our new episode, I am very happy to welcome our friend, Thomas Leuninger. Thomas is the executive director of the digital rights NGO Epicenter Works, based in Vienna, Austria. He is also a non-resident fellow at the Center of Internet Society at Stanford Law School. His background is in IT and cultural and social anthropology. Thomas has spent much of his professional life focusing on network neutrality, amongst many other digital rights issues, which is how I got to know him. Welcome, Thomas.
Hello, so glad to be here.
Thomas, it's so great to have you with us. You've been a friend of both of ours for some time, and I've gotten to see your career grow, a professional career that's been marked by your work in the digital rights space and ensuring an internet that really is for humans. So let me start by asking you, what made you jump from anthropology and social studies to the internet? And what do you think are currently the biggest challenges that are facing users, well, or humans, online?
Great question. Thank you, Gillian. I mean, my story is a little bit very classical story of anthropologists. Back in the day when I was in university, I actually started to study the field of the hacker community and digital rights community. And then the same thing happens that always happens with anthropologists. We are going native. So I became part of the field, which of course took away all scientific distance and objectivity, but it gave me a very beautiful job and really passion in my life. I was always active in activism in some form or another. Like, I started LGBTQ rights when I was a teenager, anti-racism, and then digital rights was just the first thing that didn't get boring after a few months. And I started off very early on with data retention, before Snowden, before Assange, when this all was a niche issue. And I'm just amazed how much the issue has risen to prominence. And like, Hollywood is on strike right now because of AI. We rarely have an election where digital rights is not at play. And so I also feel a lot of responsibility for the work that we do, which I see as working and ensuring that fundamental rights are protected online, that technology serves humans and not the other way around. And even in the pandemic, there have been so many digital rights issues that suddenly become center stage. And I think in a way, it's also a moment that we should seize upon, because more and more people realize that they depend on technology for their lives and that they want technology that's deserving of their trust, which sadly in many cases right now is not the place, both when it comes to our relationship with our governments and of course big corporations.
Thank you very, very much for this, Thomas. And I find it fascinating that, you know, you started from anthropology and you moved, and it's great that we have people that they have this background on social sciences and are able to interpret humans, because Gillian and I repeatedly have been saying in this podcast, it is all about humans at the end of the day. So I am going to jump right into one of the most perhaps human policies that is about that has emerged in Europe, and you and I have been talking and working a lot on this. And of course, I'm talking about the fair share elephant in the room, which is currently being debated in Europe. So, for anyone who, you know, for our listeners who might not be very much involved in internet policy, the European Commission is currently considering ways to mandate that a small number of big technology companies, you know, Google and Netflix and Meta and so on and so forth, should pay a small number of telecommunications providers, Deutsche Telekom and Telefonica are examples, to carry the traffic so that users can access the requested services. So an example here, a clear example would be Netflix, would be required to pay Telefonica, let's say, so that anyone can watch our favorite shows. Now, this doesn't sound that unreasonable, or does it? Can you please explain to us why this policy proposition is really problematic, according to your opinion?
Sure. Thank you, Konstantinos. So if you come from the field of net neutrality like I do, then it's quite obvious why this issue is really contrary to how the internet is supposed to work. because the internet is different than TV networks, where you have to pay in order to distribute your content, and you are either a TV channel or a receiver, which is a television who cannot speak. And net neutrality, in a way, is what sets the internet apart from previous telecommunication networks. And it used to be the case in telephony world. Then when I called you, my provider actually has to pay your telephone provider for terminating the call. This is the way that telephony networks have worked worldwide. And it's also one of the reasons why we have seen not a lot of competition in that market. Because, of course, if you have many customers, you make a lot of money without doing anything, by just keeping your customers reachable. And putting that model of the old telephony era on top of the internet is a long-term lobbying goal of the telecom industry. We have seen an effort to basically have exactly this idea called sending party pays in 2013 at UN level at the ITU. And it was stopped very early on, this proposal in 2013, because the resistance was very widespread and basically all of the players besides the telecoms agreed that this would be a horrible idea for the internet. And the arguments that were used back then are still valid now. It would basically make it very hard to become popular on the internet. It would give big telecom companies a lot of power and a competitive advantage. Basically, also on the telecoms market, so a smaller ISP would have a very much harder time to compete, to survive. And if we know one thing in Europe, that would be that competition is really essential for the telecom market. You need those big companies that own the pipes of the internet to be under constant pressure of their competitors. Otherwise, you have very high prices, like in the US, for example. And one other problem is that, of course, Google or Netflix and Meta might be able to pay, but many of the smaller providers simply will not be able to make deals with all of the telecom operators whose customers they might want to reach. So it would also go away from the current principle of the internet is that you can start a service, rent a server somewhere on the world, and you are reachable from day one to everyone. That would be a success story from the past if this model succeeds. And yeah, this idea from 10 years ago is right now in the hallways of Brussels, because we have a commissioner, Thierry Breton, who used to be the CEO for France Telecom, and who adopted this idea from the telecom industry. And since May 2022, we are in the midst of a huge lobbying battle around this. And originally, it was framed as just big tech versus big telco. And we immediately jumped into the debate and widened it and engaged many more stakeholders and told them that they should speak up from their perspective what this would mean to them. And now I'm happy to say that we have really reached not just the consumer protection organizations that say this would be bad for consumers, it would limit their freedom of choice, prices would increase. We have sports rights associations and other copyright holders that say, not actually, this would be really bad for intellectual property, for creativity. You have the public broadcasters that say, this would be bad for media plurality. We have a job to do in a democracy to deliver independent news to people, and this would make it harder to us. You have startups that say, we could no longer innovate and grow in Europe if this comes. And you have internet exchanges, like those hubs that bind the internet together. And they also say, this would be really bad for our ability to have a stable internet. Resilience is a strong factor. And the next pandemic, it might not be as easy to have the networks cope with a spike in demand if this would come. And lastly, the regulators, the agencies of every member state that are in charge with regulating telecom companies. And even they say this would be a bad idea because that market works and there's no reason to regulate it. So why fix something that's not broken? And the regulators are also confirming something that we said very early on, which basically is that this is incompatible with net neutrality, full stop. it would be the contradiction of net neutrality, because it would mandate discrimination, it would limit freedom of choice. And so there's really so many, basically all of society is against it, besides the telecom lobby and the European Commission, sadly, which is also saying something about the state of the EU.
So thank you for this. And, you know, you and I, as I said, we have been discussing this for the past year, and you know very well where I stand on this and the concerns that I have. But one of the things that really bugs me and really concerns me is this last point that you've raised, that currently in Europe, there is an overwhelming majority of stakeholders that have expressed concerns about this policy initiative. And you've mentioned them, right? I mean, we're having a very diverse industry, from copyright owners to big tech, of course, and startups and other businesses that are doing, you know, that are online. You have the regulators, you have consumer organizations, you even have smaller telcos actually saying that this is really a bad idea. Yet, we are seeing this insistence coming from the European Commission. And that really, really concerns me. Does it concern you? And where do you think we're going to land? Because it seems that Commissioner Breton, who is responsible for this file, seems determined to see this through. So where do you sit on all this? And, you know, how do you see why do you think this is happening? I mean, it should be, I don't think it's just that, oh, I used to be a CEO, you know, for a telco company in my previous life, so I am really insistent to give this to them. There must be something bigger there, no?
Yeah, I mean, I cannot read Breton's mind, but I mean, there are obvious factors that are at play here. On the one hand, what we see is a huge appetite to regulate big tech in Europe. This old joke, the Americans built the internet, the Europeans are regulating it, comes true these days. And we also have a real problem, particularly in Europe, because many of these companies are simply too big and they don't pay their fair share of taxes. The tax avoidance is widely known and creates legitimate grievances in large parts of society. And I think with this idea of resurfacing the standing party pay proposal 10 years after its original advent, they are tapping into general sentiment that big tech is a problem. But with many internet regulatory proposals, they might set out to limit the power of big tech, but actually they end up strengthening it, like upload filters and the copyright directive. It was a very similar story. YouTube is the only one who can really comply to that. And many smaller competitors will find themselves incapable of actually adhering to the law if they ever get that popular. And so that there is a clear a reason why it has become more likely. And I think Breton thought that an unconventional approach here would allow him to just ride that wave and fastly deliver on his promise to his colleagues in telecom companies. But here the resistance from so many stakeholders, and I'm proud to be part of that community, really stopped him in his tracks. And it was not just the stakeholders that we mentioned before and to many others. It was also governments like the Netherlands, Germany, Austria, Denmark. There's so many countries that are also saying, no, this is a really bad idea, please don't. Mm. And one of the arguments they use is also, we have actually guidelines how we make laws in Europe. And before you propose legislation, you need to do a consultation and an impact assessment. And 7 countries a year ago sent a letter to the Commission saying, why don't you adhere to your own guidelines? I mean, this really looks like capture. And it tells you a lot. I mean, I'm a staunch pro-European. I always was. But it's just problematic to see that they are kind of not adhering to their own standards whenever it's favorable special interests.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, this brings me to the next question kind of perfectly, talking more a little bit about Europe and regulation. Let's shift gears from net neutrality just a bit to talk about privacy and encryption, which I know is another topic that's near and dear to all of our hearts. So now the European Commission is also considering regulation on CSAM, or child sexual abuse material, which we will say CSAM for the rest of this podcast, so hopefully everyone will know what we're talking about. In fact, right now we're seeing plenty of jurisdictions around the world, including the EU, of course, trying to figure out how best to deal with this serious problem. But in most cases, these discussions appear to create a dichotomy between safety on the one side, the kind of think of the children dialogue, and then privacy on the other side. I personally believe that we don't have to sacrifice privacy for some semblance of safety. But right now, what we're seeing is encryption being portrayed as the biggest problem or the biggest barrier to fighting CSAM. I'm curious for your thoughts on this. Do you agree with that? What do you think?
I absolutely agree. And I have to say that CSAR regulation is truly one of the most dangerous pieces of legislation that we have seen this term and for a long time. It would really end a lot of the freedoms and technologies that we really need as building blocks in order to have technology safe, in order to have it serve the humans and be trustworthy and reliable. The thing that really puzzles me is that it was always clear from the start where the problem would be. And the regulatory impact assessment from the Commission, even before the law was announced, said it would be unconstitutional. The Parliament's legal assessment says it's unconstitutional. And even the Council, who never agrees with us, their legal services also said this will violate the Charter. And so why would you make a law that will not survive more than 3 years because the European High Court will strike it down. So this is really a very problematic way of legislating in plain sight of violation of the Charter and of our fundamental rights. But yet the Commission seems to be absolutely on track to do this. And while we have so much criticism from many unlikely allies on this issue, they have not changed their course. And so I think it will need all of our energies. It's one of these all hands issues where everybody needs to get involved and really do their part in order to prevent this. And the CSAR regulation is also in a way, some really bad ideas always pop up in more than one place. We have the online safety bill in the UK. The fair share issue we just mentioned has already spread from Europe to Brazil, to India, to Caribbean countries. And the thing is, the other side can also do copy paste. And it seems to me that we are right now at a point where very fundamental principles are threatened, and Europe always prouds itself as being the leader when it comes to digital rights regulation. And with the GDPR and the net neutrality bill in 2016, they actually were. But Europe can also lead in a bad way. And I think we have a responsibility here to not just give lip service to fundamental rights, but to also show what they mean in the 21st century. And sadly, we are not always delivering on that responsibility.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, currently it seems like we're having a democratic deficit, right, in many, many ways in Europe. And I was just reading, for instance, that Politico now is reporting that Breton was very keen to take on the idea of Macron and shut down social media during times of unrest, which is something, of course, that, you know, I would love to hear your reaction, because when I read it, I was, oh my God, we are portraying to be this great democracy, but deep down we are no better than the Chinas or any other authoritarian country in this world, if we even have a discussion about this, let alone if we actually implement it. So, you know, I would like to hear your reaction on this, Thomas, and also a little bit to insist on this encryption and see something. You've mentioned the online safety bill in the UK, and in the UK in particular, because conversations on CSAM and the online safety bill are more advanced than Europe, we already have seen some reactions coming from messaging apps. Signal in particular and WhatsApp have said to the government that if the law goes through in the way it's currently written, they will have no option but to leave the country, to leave the UK market. Do you think those reactions are warranted? Do you think that they are exaggerated? And at the end of the day, what is the best way forward, especially for a company like Signal, which prouds itself and thankfully is out there to protect users' rights, privacy, sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. And Signal's role in this debate has been extremely helpful. So has WhatsApp, by the way, because I think it's the responsibility of these companies, in the case of Signal, the foundation, to clearly state what such a proposal would mean for their service and for their users. And Meredith Whittaker really has been instrumental in the debate in the UK, and I would wish her to also speak up more about what's happening in Europe. Also because when she's talking in the UK, the Europeans don't connect those dots. They don't feel like, we have the same problem here. Actually, we do. And those attacks on end-to-end encryption, it's just absolutely correct of them to say, no, we would have to leave the market because we would not, we wouldn't violate the law and we wouldn't change our service. So we have to leave the area. And that would be devastating. I mean, so many people rely on end-to-end encryption and on the confidentiality of their communication. So, we in Austria know this very well. As you might know, we have an all-party consensus against the CISA regulation. Because we had so many chat scandals recently that even the conservatives understand that chat messages are something really private that needs to be protected and not something that you can scan with a machine and just whenever the computer with heuristic thinks that this might be illegal, sends the message to the police, which is basically how all of these systems work. And so that is truly something where you need to make it concrete. You need to do this with unlikely allies. And thankfully, we do have a proliferation of these technologies that makes them known and even everyday habits for many people in society. And I think if we could tap into that resource, we actually have a way to win this debate. I am an old grassroots campaigner, and I think whenever we can make people truly care about these things, explain why they matter to them, we have a way to win the political debate. So I think actually if we would explain the issue a little bit better, if we could work cross communities, also not just in the digital rights silo, but with many other groups, then we could really have a bottom-up approach to make this untenable and either have the law revoked or at least have it changed in a way that it's no longer attacking interpersonal communication and end-to-end.
Absolutely. No, and that's such an important point. One of the things that I want to get to a little bit here is, and this is just something that I'm very concerned about, and I assume that we all are as well, as we're seeing all of these governments attack, kind of create these attacks on encryption in the name of the children, in the name of other safety issues, I'm really worried about the impact that this has on people who depend on these services and the encryption protection that they offer to ensure that they're safe. And I'm really thinking here, not just about people in the EU and the UK, but also people who are operating from places where freedom of expression is not a given. And so, we're talking about the demise or the, not demise, but the kind of decrease of democracy in Europe. But what about, issues where other countries that are leaning more towards authoritarianism or are already authoritarian are impacted by laws like this, whether we're talking about EU laws and the Brussels effect or copycat laws that their own governments are putting into place. Do you think that we're entering, more into an era where the rest of the world is being impacted by European decisions?
I think we are already there. And there is a very baffling disconnect between all of these debates. I mean, I can give you several examples. NetzDG, that precursor to the Digital Services Act, a law from Germany that regulated social media platforms. It was actually quite disputed, but at the end, it has proven to be quite effective and has not led to over-censorship on social media platforms. So actually, that law kind of worked for the German context.
Right.
But what was the first country that copycatted it? Russia. Mm-hmm. And so the same legislation, like the general template of one legislation in one area, could still be very dangerous in another. And so the Brussels effect for me would also have to reflect on the impact of European legislation in other world regions. One other issue where I'm working on digital identity, It's the exact opposite way. I mean, we have so much experience in global majority countries on this issue, but Europe, in total isolation, created its own framework on this. And of course, they haven't done their homework and looked at the experiences from other countries and try to solve the problems that are inherent when you roll out these systems like over-identification, right to anonymity and pseudonymity, discrimination and inclusion. Like, they just ignored all of that. And so what I would wish Europe to do is to look a little bit more left and right. So the Brussels is too EU-centric, which might be a no-brainer, but when it comes to a policy context, this is really something I think more people should reflect on.
Yeah, no, that's such a great point. I absolutely agree. I share your concern here. Konstantinos.
I think that you really hit the nail on the head here. I have been also quite vocal about the responsibility that Europe has as this self-proclaimed global regulator for the internet, and the fact that, you know, the causalities that Europe's regulation causes, especially to other countries, even if Europe regulates well. Let's take the DSA, for example, which is, you know, admittedly a very good effort to tackle some very serious problems. You still, there's still the danger that other countries might take this law and twist it in a way that it becomes undemocratic. So if you're already coming from a place where you're creating law with hugely democratic gaps, then there is no question that these laws are going to be replicated in ways that are pretty problematic and concerning. So I have a question about a little bit of international things, and I will let it, you know, but for the time being, you've mentioned digital identity, and I know that there is an issue in Europe, but frankly, I personally have not followed it very closely. Can you tell us a little bit what is happening and why should our listeners be very concerned about issues of digital identity in Europe?
You are in very good company, Konstantinos, because it seems that nobody is aware of the eIDAS reform. This legislation creates a very novel thing. Basically, it's called a European Digital Identity Wallet. It's an app on your smartphone, and it allows you to identify yourself, verify attributes about yourself, like your age, your driver license, your COVID status. And it also is a means to log into services like Facebook or YouTube. And you can also legally sign documents with this. And this app will be available to all European citizens, natural and legal persons. And it basically, if the proliferation is where it is expected to be, and the Commission has done a lot by forcing the Facebooks and Googles of this world to support this new wallet, it really has the potential to change how we deal with identification online. Because it's a ubiquitous infrastructure that works towards government agencies, you can do e-government with it, but also towards the private sector. So you could see this when you are going to the supermarket, because you could have your customer card in there. You might need it when you're checking into a flight or a train. You might also have your hotel key on there. You will probably use it to verify your age on social media sites in the near future. Or you might also be asked to identify yourself when you are entering a government building, because it will also work offline and online. So it's a quite powerful piece of technology that has many functions of society tied to it. There is a huge economic interest from many industries to have this, because right now identifying people is still quite expensive. Depending on the procedure, a few euros up to 10 euros for every individual identification.
Wow.
With this system, it will be zero. So we have, for more than 2 years now, pointed out all of the problems that are tied to this legislation. And I can honestly tell you, I've been doing now digital rights for, I don't know, like 14 years as a hobby, 10 years as a job. And I've never worked on something where I had so many sleepless nights. Can we get this right? Or will this always be something that we regret? And we just try to build as many safeguards as possible into this thing. A key one is a non-discrimination provision. whoever is not using this system cannot in any way be put at a disadvantage, both in accessing government services, also with corporate services. So you, in every situation, you have a right to not use this wallet. And that would be a right that you could also litigate if someone is not adhering to it. We want unobservability so that this piece of technology, which would basically span in all areas of your life, from your interactions with the government, to your work life, to your education life, to your social media, like whenever you log into any TikTok or Facebook, you know, that such a system cannot be observable from a central vantage point. So if the government would know about user behavior and transactions, they would know too much. That can never be proportionate. And then things like use case regulations to limit this system wherever possible to legal know your customer cases and not just, but Facebook has a real name policy, so you have to give them your legal name. And all of that is to say that, yeah, we are quite far into the negotiations. I'm happy to say that all of the things that we wanted are in the Parliament's position, in the first reading position from the European Parliament. We're going to actually get almost all of the safeguards that we originally wanted adopted. And we are now in trilogue. End of June, we had the last trilogue round, political trilogue with the Swedish presidency, and we could kill one of the monsters, a unique persistent identifier, basically a serial number for European citizens handed out at birth. So ultimately, everything is still in the cards. We are right now in trilogue stage. Parliament has been really good to us. We got all of our safeguards adopted by the members of the European Parliament. But now we need to agree on the final text. So we hope to have a conclusion by the end of this year. And it's really one of these things where Europe might set a really good worldwide standard or a really bad one. And that's why we are working on it. And eIDAS will be key for many other issues like the age verification in the CESA regulation, the chat control bill, but also things like the European health data space when it comes to your doctor data and your medical data, that would also be tied to that new digital identity system. So I think it's a reform that deserves more attention.
Absolutely. And actually, you know, whilst you were talking, Thomas, I was literally thinking about security, mainly the security challenges and the security risks that such a policy will have. And I can tell you right now that Greece is currently actually in the process of perhaps implementing and might be the first country that will do that. After going through 4 years of massive digitization, the government currently is selling this idea of centralized online services through the digital government wallet as the new way forward, and the citizens are buying it. So I am very glad that people like yourself are working on this and they're thinking of those issues that we need to make sure are present in order for this to be able and work. And I will stop talking because now suddenly I just got really concerned about what's happening in Europe. Gillian?
That happens to me on a daily basis. So I'm just going to throw out one more question. Our second to last question, because we do have a favorite question that we ask everyone at the end, a fun one. But this is my last serious, serious question. So we know, you know, you're doing a lot of work on the Cybercrime Convention, as are a number of my colleagues, and I'm sure some of Konstantinos is as well. This is a UN process, not an EU one, which Russia started as a way to focus on issues of cybercrime. But we're now also seeing an attempt to create something that looks more like an internet treaty. Do you think that that's a correct assessment? And do you think that the UN is the right place to be having these discussions?
Yeah, really good question. I was hoping that we could touch on that because that's also a novel issue for us. Since this year, we also started to work on UN level because there is actually a huge Vienna office in, there's actually a huge UN office in Vienna. And that process truly triggered us because, as you rightfully pointed out, this really has the potential to redraft criminal law all around the world. It would establish a catalogue of mandatory surveillance practices, a catalogue of mandatory criminal offences, basically a wide collection of random criminal things that are done together with a computer, suddenly it's cybercrime. And the most drastic change that might come from this UN Cybercrime Convention is the way in which law enforcement agencies in different countries cooperate with each other. Because right now they are relying on mostly mutual legal assist treaties, so bilateral agreements between states that govern how their police is cooperating. And with this treaty, you could actually have a global interoperable system for these types of requests. Could you please seize that server, question that person, or have this surveillance measure implemented? So that is truly scary in a way. And at the same time, I mean, I understand why this process is happening, because there is, of course, cybercrime in many other countries. And there is also a very legitimate thing when it comes to training the police. I think everybody wants law enforcement that knows how the internet works, that is capable of acting on a real crime that's happening there. Also, because if victims come to the police, they need to get help there and they need to be taken seriously, which sadly is very often not the case. So a lot of it is training and resource sharing. I think that part is good. But when we talk about global surveillance practices, and as it is in the cards, also mandatory spyware in for every country in the world, there are clearly disastrous things there. And we are right now fighting as hard as we can to have human rights safeguards in the treaty. For example, if a country with a pure human rights records demands some surveillance measures that you can refuse on grounds of human rights standards. And there's a coalition of NGOs that we are glad to be a part of. And for us, the main focus is really those human rights standards and privacy standards and the spyware thing. And we have the next session in New York, end of August, and then in January, a last negotiation session. The General Assembly in June 2024 will be the one voting on this convention. And we hope that we can either get proper safeguards into this treaty or maybe also have it fail. Because, I mean, it would really reshape criminal law all around the world. And if you take spyware as a mandatory provision in there, then that fight would also be almost completely lost in so many countries. So that's why we have to be very mindful here.
Absolutely. And I have the feeling that it is the first of many, many processes that the UN will be involved with. And my problem, of course, you both know it very well, is the fact that it's inclusion, right? And it's very difficult for non-governments to be part of the UN system. The UN system is not accustomed to be working through a multi-stakeholder framework.
Indeed.
Exactly. So especially for civil society, it is extremely onerous to be following such processes because it's costly, it is resource intensive, and of course, there are doors that are shut. However, it's really awful to end with that note. So we have come up with Gillian with a question that we feel allows us to end on a happy note with our guest. And that question, Thomas, to you is, what is your favorite internet human moment?
My favorite internet human moment. I mean, that's close to home, but podcasts.
Oh.
Yeah. A lot of my life and like my interests and also good friends, like everything circles around podcasts in a way. And I have to say that, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, good. God, I have an alert here that I lost connection. I'm going to start again. Yeah, it's podcasts. And that's because like I wouldn't be in digital rights without podcasts. I wouldn't have met so many friends if it weren't for podcasts. Because I always like talking to people. That's maybe also why I studied anthropology. And also listening to them. And I did free radio very early on. Like I had a radio show at a very local free radio station. But then when this whole thing moved online and I experienced podcasts for the first time, I found my people. And so that's why I feel quite at home in this medium.
That was really nice.
Well, we're happy to be your people on this particular day.
Yes, we are. Thomas, that's us. Unfortunately, our time is up. The three of us can talk for hours and hours as we do. Thank you so very much for being a guest to our podcast.
And keep up the incredible work.
Yeah, and all the work that you're doing, exactly. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a great honor. And yeah, please continue this podcast for 10 more seasons.
We will do our best.
Thank you. You're the best.
We want to give a quick thanks to, well, we don't have any sponsors, but we do have somebody who helps us a lot on this podcast, and that's Javier Paero. Thank you, Javi, for all of your help with your editing. And that's a wrap.
Thanks.
Bye.